This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To, Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you once again. A brand new edition of Trainer Talk tonight, and an edition that I'm really looking forward to. Of course, we are broadcasting the Preakness Stakes coming up this Saturday on the Horse Racing Radio Network, and it's always special to be at Pimlico, Old Hilltop in Baltimore, Maryland, and I thought it would be great to talk with a couple of the trainers who are so prominent here in the state of Maryland, one being Tim Keefe, the other being Kieran McGee, and you're going to hear both those stories coming up here this evening. And Tim Keefe, somebody who is very familiar with Maryland. He is a Maryland native. He has trained so many winners here in the state, currently more than 380 career winners. He's closing in on 400 very quickly, and he is going to be my first guest tonight. Kieran will be here in the second half of the program. So without further ado, let's bring in Tim Keefe. And, Tim, thanks so much for taking a little time here on Trainer Talk.
No problem, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you on board and looking forward to hearing your story here this evening. Let's go back to the beginning. I mentioned, first of all, you grew up in this area. You're very familiar with Maryland racing. Where did it all begin for Tim Keefe?
Well, I grew up in a suburb of Laurel and in a very horsey area. I got my first job working on a small horse farm when I was 13. In return for doing the stable duties and such, they would let me exercise their horses. So that was kind of the first taste I had with as far as the race horses.
So were you always a fan of horses and horse racing, or how did that come about? Where did you get your first
taste?
That's
how I first started with the horse racing. But after working on the farm with Bev and those guys, I joined Pony Club. I was in the pony club. I fox hunted. I evented. I showed horses. And so I kind of did a little bit of everything. Growing up through high school, I evented and was in pony club. From there, I worked my way through college. I worked on I worked for Janet Elliott, steeplechase trainer. I broke horses, yearlings, two-year-olds for what was going to be my future father-in-law, Billy Gilbert. And then from there, I took out my trainer's license in the mid-90s.
So who took you to the racetrack for the first time?
Well, it was Joe Aitchison. And Joe Aitchison was champion steeplechase jockey. And Joe had a deal. He said, if you take me to a bunch of the point-to-points, the hunt meets, he said, I'll introduce you to everybody. And that's kind of how I got started from there. I worked for Jack and Gretchen Moberly. It was my first galloping job when I was in college. I worked for Ronnie Cartwright and Jimmy Murphy. So those were kind of the guys that I grew up with and started out with.
And you mentioned joining Pony Club when you were very young. Did I read somewhere that you actually bought your first horse when you were around 15 years old?
I did, yes. Brought it with a neighbor of mine. She lived across the street from me. She was in her 50s, and she had horses when she was a kid. So she wanted to, she wanted a horse that she could ride during the week when I was in school. I had the horse that I could show and do stuff on the weekends. So, we went to an auction and not really knowing what we were doing. And we spent $800 for a old chestnut gelding that they advertised as 12 years old. I think he was probably more like 22. But anyway, it worked out great. We named him Split Decision, and she would ride him on the trails during the week. Yeah, he was the first horse that I could call my own, or at least partly my own.
Well, and I guess from that point on, you were hooked at that point, right?
I was. I definitely was. I did a little bit of sports when I was in school, but I focused most of my time on the horses. And I loved eventing. I love fox hunting. I love doing all that. But I just got to the point where I figured I couldn't really make a career of show on horses, so I needed to do something else. I'm pretty competitive, and I love the fast pace of the horses. I love the racehorse game, so it's kind of where I graduated.
Yeah, and you mentioned going to school. You graduated from the University of Maryland, so you're a Terrapin. You still cheer for them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. University of Maryland, College Park, yep.
But was there a point in time when you decided or thought that maybe you might want to do something other than be involved with the horses when you were going to school, or no?
You know, I never really did. I remember a conversation I had with Ron Cartwright. I was galloping for him, and I guess it was exam week. Something was coming up, and I told Ronnie, I said, you know, the next day or two I've got early exams, so I'm going to have to be in early and out early. And he said, that's fine. He says, he asked me the question. He said, what do you envision? What's your goal once you graduate? What do you want to be when you graduate from college? And I looked at him. I said, I want to be a horse trainer. I want to train racehorses. And I'll never forget in his English accent, laughing. He says, you want to be a racehorse trainer? He says, then what the hell are you going to school for then? but it was important to me to go to school. It was important to learn the business aspect of running your own business. No matter what you do, you have to know how to run your own business. You have to be able to manage your money, and you have to, you know, the communication skills that you get with going through school and what you have to know in dealing with not just horses, but I think that's where some trainers fall off. They're great with their horses, but they don't necessarily know how to communicate and deal with the business and dealing with the owners and with the dollars and cents. And I think that's what really helped me in going to school.
How about your parents? What was their reaction when you graduated and said, hey, you know what? Thanks for the education, but I want to go be involved with horse racing.
Well, Dad wasn't too keen on that. Although he had no room to talk. Dad and my grandfather, they're both, you know, that's probably where it originated from. They used to love to go to the races and gamble. But Dad wasn't too keen on the idea. He wanted me to focus on a 9-to-5 job, work for the government. You could have the weekends off, holidays, you know, paid vacation, sick leave, and that sort of thing. None of which you get when you have your own business training racehorses. But he kind of came around pretty quick, and he actually helped me. He was one of the first guys I ever trained for, my dad. He went to Timonium, he and I did, after I graduated, and he bought two of the first two-year-olds that I ever trained. Now, the first one broke his leg in his first start, and the second horse that we owned together threw a jockey coming out of the gate, so we really didn't get a great start. But from the many years together, Dad and I had a partnership called B&T Racing Stable, where we would buy horses, and we had a couple brood mares we would breed and race some of our own horses. So it was a great partnership for many, many years. And Dad absolutely started me off. And I know my father just passed away last week. So he was very proud of the fact that I've been doing okay and have made a career, fairly successful career. I mean, depends on your point of view of success, but I'm able to do what I love doing. I wake up every morning, enjoy going to work, enjoy what I'm doing. So I know he is very proud of that.
So even after that initial shock of saying, okay, this is what I want to do for a living, he became very supportive, is what it sounds like.
Absolutely was, yes.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story. And then after you got into that side of the business, I guess initially it was you wanted to be a jump jockey, right? Was that your first inclination?
Yes. In the back of my mind, I really went to work for Janet Elliott because she was a great horsewoman, and I really wanted to learn. I did have the idea of being a jump jockey, but I quickly learned that that's not where I was going to, I didn't want to end up being that as a career. It was a great horsemanship. Jump trainers are very good horsemen, horse people, and I learned a great deal from Janet. And I purposely wanted to go there and look at a different aspect of the horses. I mean, as I said, I fox hunted, I showed horses, I invented horses, I broke yearlings, and I was around the race horses at the racetrack, but I wanted also to see how they did it on the farm, steeplechasing, and I learned a great deal of information working for Janet.
Did you get to ride in some flat races too, or was it just steeplechase?
I did, yes. I did. I rode a few flat races. I was an amateur jockey, and that was an enormous amount of fun. I really enjoyed that. And it gave me a different perspective too. You know, a lot of trainers have just trained horses. They've never really ridden in a race. And it's until you've ridden in a race, you know, you see with the jockeys, you give your jockey instructions before they go out for a race. And you know, as soon as the gates open, things can change. There are all different circumstances that are beyond the jockey's control. So it just gives a trainer who's been in that position before a different point of view when you have a situation like that come up during a race where the race doesn't go according to the directions you've given a jockey. So again, it gave me another point of view.
Yeah, do you find that as somebody who has been there and done that and actually ridden in a race, do you find that maybe you're a little more critical or more forgiving of riders when they
aboard
your
horses?
I'm much
more forgiving.
Really?
Yeah, yes.
Because you've been there, done that.
Pardon me?
Because you've been there, done that. You know what it's all about.
I've been there, I've done that, I know what, yes, absolutely.
So how come?
I mean, I try to match my riders up with the horses, and I try to ride the best riders I can get, the ones that I think get along the best with the horses, and make good decisions. But I'm not naive enough to think that everything's going to go right all the time. You know, things are going to go wrong. Things aren't going to go according to plan. And you know, one of the things I learned from Jack, all those guys, Jack Mobley and Ronnie Cartwright and Jimmy Murphy, is they never got upset at things. Getting upset isn't going to do any good. It's not going to change. It's just don't make the same mistake twice. Learn from what happened, learn from your mistakes, and just move forward. I try not to get upset or wound up about things. Things sometimes go beyond your control, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Talking with trainer Tim Keefe on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So how come you never pursued the career in riding? Did you just eventually decide, hey, I want to train horses instead?
Yes. One, I was getting a little bit big, and two, I've always had aspirations to be a trainer. Or just ever since I was a kid, I always read about some of the famous trainers when I was younger, that's always what I wanted to do. Yes.
Will you still get on your horses in the morning now?
I don't get on any of the horses right now. For many, many years, I galloped my own horses, but probably about 5 or 6 years ago, I stopped galloping my own horses. On occasion, out at the farm, I might go riding with my wife or the kids or something, but other than that, I don't do any riding anymore.
Yeah, you mentioned your wife, and you mentioned working for your future father-in-law at one point earlier in your career. How did you end up meeting your wife?
I met my wife in Pony Club. My wife, Rumsey, her mother was a coach of mine, and I would go up to their farm up in Churchville and take lessons and with my event horse and that sort of thing. And they lived on a farm. They broke race horses. They had a racetrack and everything. And my wife's father had asked me if I would get on some of the horses up there. So I started getting on some of the yearlings up there. I helped him break some of the yearlings. And, you know, kind of one thing led to another, and we started dating, and kind of 18 years later, we've been married and have 4 kids, and it's been great. She has a lot of the same interests as I. She takes a lot of my slower race horses and turns them into show horses and event horses, and then rehomes them, reschools them, and finds new careers for them. So it's been a great, opportunity for both of us.
Yeah, it makes for a great partnership. And you have 4 kids, is that right?
Yes, we have 4 kids. My oldest is a daughter. She's in Pony Club, actually the same Pony Club from which I graduated. She's 14. Wow. I have a son, 12, a second son who is 10, and my youngest is a daughter who is 7.
Now, are they into riding at all or showing or anything like that?
My oldest daughter is, my youngest daughter appears to have same kind of interest. The two boys have zero interest in riding. Football, lacrosse, basketball, any of the sports that involve a ball, that's what they love to do. But they don't really care about the riding.
Do they care about the racing? And when dad has horses running, do they like that?
Yeah, they enjoy watching some of the races. But, you know, they don't really have a real keen interest on it, at least at this point. Right now they don't. They're both in 4-H. Actually, the 3 oldest are in 4-H. The oldest two are in the Beef Club, and then my youngest son's in the he has in the Lamb Club, the Swine Beef and or the Swine Club, 4-H.
Wow. So what if one of the girls comes to you one day and says, "Dad, I want to be a jockey"? What do you tell them?
I'm going to tell her absolutely not. But I remember what my father told me, though, when I told him I wanted to be a trainer. So I'll definitely be forgiving if that's exactly what she wants to do. But I'll persuade her not to. But I certainly know how much joy and happiness it's brought me. So I'll be cognizant of that fact if she really, really pressures me on letting her do it.
Yeah, how about if one of them wants to be a trainer? Do you just go with the flow with that as well?
Yeah, I guess I'd have to be, shouldn't I? I'm not sure I would like it, but absolutely. If that's what they really aspire to do, I wouldn't stop them. Want to try to stop them from doing anything.
So tell me about your first career winner. I guess that came July 22nd, 1993.
93 or 94?
I'm looking at a horse via Hawaii. Yeah.
Via Hawaii was claimed. We claimed her. Let me back up a little bit. She was owned by a professor in the University of Maryland, an economics professor, Malcolm Comer. And when he found out that I had done, I guess I did a paper for him on the racehorse business. And he found out that I had aspirations to be a trainer, and he had aspirations of being an owner. So he went out and we claimed this filly, and it was the first horse I ever trained and I ever won with, was Via Hawaii. And it was a great partnership we had for many, many years.
Wow. And then, as I recall, your first jump race winner was Go For It Stutz. Is that right?
That's right. Go For It Stutz. Yeah. With my best friend, Sean Clancy. He was the jockey on the horse. Go For It Stutz. It wasn't Montpelier. It was Foxfield. And then I came back.
So you actually gave a leg up to Clancy.
And we won the Noel Lang. That was at Montpelier. So yep. I did. I had a few flat horses and a few jumpers at that point. And then I gradually just changed all over to the flat horses.
You know, Clancy takes a lot of credit for that win, saying it was an outstanding ride.
It absolutely was an outstanding ride. If they were pari-mutuel wagering in that race, I promise you I would have been at least 50-1 in that race. And and he won it. He gave that horse a great ride, as he did most of the horses that he rode. He was a good rider.
Yeah, how cool is it to be part of something like that, or to have a good friend of yours, you mentioned your best friend, to have him as part of that moment in your life? It has to be a pretty neat moment for you.
It's a great moment, something you can never take away. I have that win picture, both of those win pictures up in my office, as a matter of fact. I mean, what's that, 20 plus years ago? And, you know, a lot of wins have gone by since then, but those two wins are framed and up on my wall. It's great. Yep, something, again, you can never take away.
Well, and so it wasn't long afterwards that you finally won your first flat stakes as well, and that came in your home state of Maryland, and that had to be quite remarkable.
That was Anorex in the Maryland Million. If I'm not mistaken, that was Anorex in the Maryland Million Distaff, I think it was. That was a horse that Ron Cartwright, a trainer from which I galloped for and worked for, the one who laughed and asked what I was going to school for then if I wanted to train racehorses. He had given me that horse for some of his best owners, Neo Culpa Stables, with Bill and Phyllis Dixon. And Bill and Phyllis had won two stakes on that day. It was Maryland Million Day with Ronnie Cartwright. And this filly was in the last race that day. She was, I don't know what she was. I think she was 30-1, 35-1. Nobody expected her to do anything. And Steve Hamilton rode her for me. Steve Hamilton also rode my first winner via Hawaii. Steve Hamilton rode Anorex for me, and she won that day. It was fantastic. It was great. It was a great feeling.
Wow. And how many horses would you say that you have in your stable, kind of on average now, most years?
Right around, I'll keep between 30 and 35 horses as a pretty much an average. I get a little bit higher in the springtime right now. I think I'm up to 40. But then in the fall to winter, I'll send some of the grass horses home. Things slow down a little bit. I might get down to 30. So right around 35.
Is that a good number, or would you like to have more?
Nah, the perfect number for me. They're between 30 and 40 is perfect. I really don't want to get any bigger than that.
Tell me a little bit about your philosophy when it comes to training horses, Tim.
I take my time with them. I treat all the horses like they're my own. I try to develop a horse rather than trying to get them to the races as quickly as I can and what I can get out of them. I'm conservative. So when I have a new owner that'll come to me and they want to send me horses, I make sure that they know there are a lot of trainers from which to choose from. I take a conservative path. I'm very slow, very meticulous. If I get a 2-year-old in the summertime, I might give them a little bit of schooling, get them used to acclimated to the gate, a little bit of basic work. A lot of times I'll send them back home for the rest of the summer and into the fall just to let them grow up and develop it and mature. Every horse is different. Some come along fast, some come along much slower. So I try to figure out which of those horses will benefit from that time off and growing and maturing, both mentally and physically, and then get them back and put each of them on their own path. I take my time with them, and I try not to rush. And that works for some of the owners, and some of the owners, that doesn't work, and that's fine. Everybody's a little different. But I try to take a slow, methodical approach to training each horse individually.
Trainer Tim Keefe, my special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fazit Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Tim, are there certain horses that you've been around in your career that, for whatever reason, maybe they're not the best horses you've had, but for whatever reason, you're just never going to forget those horses?
Absolutely. I have Aitchison Lane, a really cool old horse that a friend of mine had. He was a fun horse to be around. He'd go out and give you 100% every time they run. Whether it's run for maiden eight or when I would run eight too fast to catch in one of the Maryland Million races, or every horse that goes out there, if they give you 100%, you can never ask for any more. They go out and they do their job. They seem like they have fun doing it and enjoy it. And then you can take those kind of horses and reschool them and find different careers for them. Those are kind of the horses that I always remember. Horses that'll come in, go through a couple of conditions. Maybe they're not superstars. They don't make, a boatload of money, but they come in, they do their job, and then go on and can do something else. They're fun to be around. They're fun to train. Again, those kind of horses. The horse I have right now, Rojo Perfecto, he's a lot of fun to have in the barn. He's just a good old happy kind of horse, average kind of, although he's actually running the Ladies Legends race on Friday. But, some of those kind of homegrown horses that aren't going to win, like I say, big stake races, but they're just fun to be around, fun to do things with.
Yeah, and you mentioned the name 8 Too Fast to Catch. That's a horse that really kind of put you on the map, even outside of the state of Maryland. The top quality horse. Talk to me about 8 Too Fast to Catch and tell his story a little bit.
8 Too Fast to Catch was the first horse that I bought for Arnold Heft, a great owner of mine that passed away a couple of months ago. We bought him at Timonium and as a yearling. He was slow in developing. He was kind of a gawky two-year-old, lanky and just immature backwards as a young horse. We took our time with him, got him in as a three-year-old. He still wasn't quite together, ran him in a few races. We stopped on him, took a couple of chips out of a knee, and again, just gave him time to grow up and kind of figure things out. And once he did that, the 4 and a 5 and a 6-year-old, 7, he's 8 now, he just came into himself. He's wasn't particularly easy to ride at first. A couple of great exercise riders that worked for me at the racetrack, and one kid in particular, Peter, who gets on him every day, gets along great with him, and really just kind of turned around. He needed the confidence and maturity to develop into a good horse, and he has. He's been an enormous amount of fun. Now, I've given him a little bit of time off. This spring, he'll go back into work early summer, right around June, and we'll prepare him. This will be he's 8 now, so this will be his last career, his last season, we think. And we're going to try. He's up to about $915,000 in earnings. We're going to try one more year at the Maryland Million, try to get him over the $1 million mark, and then my wife will take him and reschool him and turn him into either a show horse or a jumper or something.
It's got to be great to have your wife involved like that and to be able to know that even after they're done racing with you, that she can take them and hopefully develop them into a second career. That has to be pretty special.
It's very special. I think that's one of the things that we owe our horses. I think especially today when there's so many resources that are available to have horses where you can reschool them, you can send them out, give them second careers. It's very important to me, and I think it's our responsibility as trainers to find different spots for these horses when we're finished instead of just grinding everything we can out of them and then forgetting about them. But it's very important to me. It's one of the passions I think I have in racing is I get a big kick out of getting these horses in, doing their jobs, and then finding other homes for them. Every horse has a second career. You can find a career for every one of them. And again, that's one of the reasons why I do a fundraiser. I try to do a fundraiser every year. And two of the groups, I usually do it for two groups and raise money. And the last group, I did it for Kim Clark's group. Or last year, I did it for Kim Clark's group. And then this year, I did it for Lori Calhoun's group, the Foxy G Foundation. So anyway, yeah, I think it's very important. And I'm very fortunate that my wife, Rumsey, has got that ability to be able to do that with a lot of these horses of mine.
Yeah, don't you also do some Ironman triathlons as fundraisers as well?
I do, yeah. Those are the fundraisers that I try to do. I do those events to try to bring to raise money and bring awareness to the two groups. I usually raise money for two groups when I do these races. One is a horse-related group, like I say, either Kim Clark's group or Lori Calhoun's. And then another group is an organization that's kind of close to me. This past year, I did the second group in which I did the fundraiser for was the Almond Cancer Fund. That's a group that helps young adults that are in their families that are afflicted with cancer. So,
wow. How long do you have to train for a triathlon?
How long do I train for them? It takes about 9 months to train for one.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. What's that entail?
It entails a lot of careful scheduling, and the Ironman race is a 2.4-mile swim, it's a 112-mile bike ride, and a marathon, 26.2-mile run afterwards. So the first year that I competed in one, I had a trainer, a coach that helped me out, gave me a great training plan, trained 6 days a week. And I just fit it in when I can. I fit it in on dark days, fit it in the evenings or early in the mornings, fit it in between lacrosse and soccer games and horse shows and everything else. Just somehow we find a way to fit everything in.
Wow, that's remarkable. Great stuff. Tim Keefe here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Tim, just about a little less than a minute or so here before we have to wrap up. This has really flown by. It's been great to hear your story. But outside of the triathlons, what else do you enjoy doing outside of horse racing when you get the opportunity?
I love going with the kids and my wife. We go down to the beach a couple times a year. We try to anyway. We spend a week down with my wife's family, the brothers, sisters, cousins, and her mother. And then we do it again in the fall with my family. All of our kids, my brother's children, all get along. I love spending a lot of time with the kids together. That's probably what I enjoy most outside of the horses, is spending some time either out on the boat or out on the beach somewhere, just relaxing.
Well, Tim doesn't let much moss grow underneath them, I can tell you that. It sounds like you're a very busy man, my friend, and really appreciate you taking a little time here this afternoon on Trainer Talk. And all of our guests who appear on the program received a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strip, so we'll get that to you. And, Tim, thanks so much for being here.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
All right, Tim Keefe here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Triathlons, how about that? And he does it for fundraisers. Wow, great stuff. Kieran McGee coming up in the second half of the program. Stay tuned for that. It's next on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.
Why sell at Fasic Tipton's summer selected horses of racing age sale?
Market trends.
Current market trends create huge premiums for horses with recent form.
Timing.
The July 14th sale date falls during transition time for stables and provides meaningful racing opportunities for new owners.
Flexibility.
The online catalog only until time of sale allows for entries to be taken up to 1 week prior to the sale date.
Innovation.
The online catalog features updated pedigrees and race records as they occur, along with Rogozin sheet numbers and race replays.
Graduate success.
2013 sales grads are off to a fast start, including Grade 3 winner Candyman E and stakes winners El Sano, Chow Bella Luna, Home Run Birdie, and Jay Cito. Last year's inaugural sale was a tremendous success, with an average of $105,000, a median of $45,000, with a low RNA rate of just 15%. The Fasic Tipton Summer Selected Horses of Racing Age Sale, Monday, July 14th in Lexington, Kentucky. Nominations recommended by June 2nd. Visit FasicTipton.com for more information.
It's been more than a decade since Funnyside became the first New York bred to win the Kentucky Derby. Now, New York has two combatants hoping to follow in Funnyside's footsteps.
It's Samrat narrowly, and Samrat will stay undefeated!
So, New York-bred Samrat and his brave runner-up in both the Gotham and Withers Stakes, Uncle Cy, are both on the road to the Derby while proving that New York breeders are increasingly breeding quality thoroughbreds that can compete across America and around the world. Learn more about our awards program at nybreds.com.
Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair Strip's gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair Strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair Strips.
Have you dreamed of owning a racehorse, or have you already experienced the thrill of visiting the Winner's Circle? Either way, the inaugural Thoroughbred Owner Conference at Keeneland has something for you. Expert panel discussions, presentations from thoroughbred trainers and owners, a day at the races, social events, and even a keynote address from Hall of Fame golfer and thoroughbred owner Gary Player. Mark your calendar for the Thoroughbred Owner Conference in Lexington, Kentucky, October 13 through 16, and visit ownerview.com today to register. That's ownerview.com.
After drawing away from the field in the Kentucky Derby, can California Chrome continue his amazing run in the Preakness?
California Chrome into the final furlong. He's got a 5-length lead on his competition. It is California Chrome in front.
Tune in to find out. The 139th Preakness Stakes, this Saturday, 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern. Only here on HRRN. Go to horseracingradio.net for a complete list of affiliates or to listen live.
Hall of Fame trainer Bob Baffert came to the 2002 Preakness Stakes having dominated the race since winning his first 5 years earlier. So when War Emblem arrived at Pimlico following his Tour de Force front-running win in the Kentucky Derby 2 weeks prior, he would be attempting to give his trainer his fourth win in the middle jewel of racing's Triple Crown. A full field of 13 signed on to challenge the Derby winner, but the result would prove to be no different.
In the final furlong, just as they were in the Derby, War Emblem and Proud Citizen is surging to them as they come down to the finish. Magic Wisdom coming with a flying finish. Here comes War Emblem. War Emblem to win. He wins the Preakness, and it's on to the Belmont for a try at the Triple Crown.
War Emblem and jockey Victor Espinoza had held off the late charge of local favorite Magic Wisdom, and were on their way to the Belmont Stakes for a chance at the Triple Crown 3 weeks later. And although a stumbling beginning would cost him all chance that day, War Emblem's game win at Old Hilltop on May 18, 2002 provided another memorable moment in Preakness Stakes history.
This is Al Stahl, and you're listening to Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is the show trainers listen to, and you can see why. A really fun interview with Tim Keefe in the first half of the program, and looking forward to the second half with Kieran McGee, who is the current leading trainer here in Baltimore, Maryland at Pimlico Racecourse, and his story is outstanding. Looking forward to hearing that, but want to remind you that you can go to our website later on this evening. A podcast of this show is available for you each and every week at horseracingradio.net. All of our Trainer Talk shows presented by Fasic Tipton for you right there at horseracingradio.net. Well, Kieran, welcome to Pimlico here.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, happy to have you on board here with Trainer Talk tonight.
Thank you.
Well, let's start at the beginning. That's what this show is all about. Take me back to the beginning. You told me an interesting thing before we came on the air about your family. You're a native of Ireland. Take me back to the beginning and tell me about your family and you getting involved with racing.
Well, my father came over to work for Anheuser-Busch in Missouri as a huntsman for his hunt, bridles for a hunt, and I was born down there, so I was legal, a legal citizen. But then they went back to Ireland when I was like a year old. So
yeah,
spent the rest of it there.
Anheuser-Busch. Mm-hmm. If you're going to work for somebody, that's not a bad one to get involved with.
It was quite the place. My mother showed me many pictures down there, and her with movie stars would come and go hunting. Yeah, it was pretty. Met John Wayne, pictures of me with John Wayne and that as a child.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Do you remember any of that?
Or no.
Just the pictures?
No, yeah.
Yeah. How old were you then?
Less than a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And your dad, what was his role?
He was the huntsman down there. Okay. And so he took the people. Every week they go hunting and they'd bring a couple hundred people, go out. And it was quite the scene down there. I mean, money was no object, obviously, and they had quite the farm.
Wow. Is that what got you hooked on horses right from the beginning?
Well, my grandfather was a trainer. Like the seventh generation, it was horses in the family. So we tried to get away. And my brother was a jockey, and he did well. And he just got too big, and I tried riding, but I was terrible. And I couldn't. The weight factor, he would suffer to ride a horse. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
I prefer to eat. So
where'd your brother ride?
In Ireland, all in Ireland.
Yeah, yeah. Flat races, jump races.
Flat and jump.
Oh, he did both.
Yeah, well, he got too heavy for the flat, so he had to do the jump racing.
Yeah.
Because you can carry more weight.
Yeah, but you weren't going to make those sacrifices to be a
jockey. No, and I was bad enough that it wasn't worth it. And riding bad horses, it just wasn't worth it.
So how old were you when you first started to get involved with racing at some level? We'd go to the racetrack.
Well, as a kid, I had to. My father would make us do it. We'd have to get up in the morning before we went to school and muck stalls, and we'd have to ride out the first set before we went to school in the morning. So we were made do it. And we'd go to school, and the kids would all make horse noises because we'd smell of horses and that. We grew up with that, yeah.
Really?
They would make fun of you? Absolutely. Yeah, he smelled like a horse the whole time and making horse noises, you know.
But would you be at the barn before you would go to school?
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah.
And you had no choice?
I had no choice. It was do that or no choice.
Yeah.
No choice.
Wow. That's just but the opposite of a lot of trainers that I hear the stories where, for example, Tim Keefe in the first half of the program went to college mm-hmm. and then came out of college and his parents said, he said to his parents, I want to be involved in horse mm-hmm. racing. And there was a little kickback there for a little bit.
No, we were all expected to do it.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. So the first time you went to the racetrack, what do you remember?
And where don't was it, remember. Ireland? It was Ireland, yes. I can't remember. I remember as a kid, I was always at the races.
Yeah.
And we always had horses running and up and down the road going to the races.
How old were you when you started riding horses?
Got my first pony when I was probably about 6 or 7 years of age, and we did the gymkhanas. They call them gymkhanas in Ireland, and we'd go every weekend and had to win. There was no such thing as going to have fun. You go to win.
Really? Even you at know, that age?
Even at that age, you have to win.
It's not one of those deals where every kid gets a trophy.
No. No. When we went there, it was instilled that we had to win.
Would you win then?
It was good. We had a good pony. Yeah, he was a good pony, and I can still remember him. He was very fast, and he was a good jumper.
What was his name?
There's a funny story. You had to register every year, and his name was already taken, and my grandmother was registering him, and every name she gave was taken, so she named him Malarkey,
okay.
Which is an Irish word for BS or whatever. It's a lot of malarkey, you
right.
know. So she named him Malarkey. So every time we go to a show and they'd announce his name, I'd whip my head down. It was embarrassing, yeah. But he was good. He was a great pony, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you weren't a bad rider then. You were winning on malarkey.
On him, I was, yeah. But a jockey was not my thing.
So why did you decide that you wanted to be a jockey? Just to follow in your brother's footsteps?
My father made us do it.
Okay, really?
Yeah, yeah. We had to ride. He wanted us to do it, and we weren't going to argue with him.
Yeah.
And of course, I rode my first race in Ireland, you could get a license with your parents' consent at 15. Rode my first race the day I turned 15. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, what was that like? What do you remember?
The leading rider beat me, and Johnny Rowe was his name. I dropped my stick at the head of the lane, and I got beat ahead. But the leading rider in the country won the race. So
wow. Now your brother, older than you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he was already well on his way to a career by the time you started riding at 15.
And he just got too heavy, though. And he would sacrifice. I mean, he would go to races in a car wearing a wetsuit to try and get the water out of him. And I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
It just wasn't worth it.
Yeah. So when did you stop riding and decide that you wanted to get into training?
Well, I took a bad fall, and the doctor suggested that I not do it anymore. And I was thrilled to. When he said that, I didn't even think about it. I said, I'm done. And so then I started bartending a little bit. And
so you were out of racing completely?
I left. I started bartending and absolutely loved it. And then I managed a bar for a friend of mine. And a friend from America came. This guy owned like 6 bars in New York. He came over there and I met him. And he needed a bartender in New York for one of his bars. And I went and I came here to Timonium. And he called me, said, wait, let's wait a week and then come on up. And I started galloping horses at Timonium to make a living. And next thing, he called me like 3 weeks later and I told him, no, I'm staying here.
Wow. I didn't know there were bars in Ireland.
Oh. Been to quite a few.
I know there were a few liners in there somewhere when you started talking about being a bartender.
Yeah.
So that's what led you back to horse racing eventually?
And then I started galloping horses at Timonium. And it was easy, and you worked for 4 or 5 hours in the morning, and that was it.
How old were you then?
21.
21.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you got back on horses again, what was that like?
No, it was fun. I did enjoy it. And I did it for like 25 years, and made a good living for 25 years doing it, and worked for nearly everybody in Maryland one time or another, mostly freelanced, and I mean, it was good money. I'd go to farms in the afternoon and break horses and do all that sort of stuff.
And even that whole time when you're galloping horses here in the States, you still weren't even thinking about being a trainer?
Crossed my mind.
Really?
Never crossed my mind. And people would say to me, I'm not going to do it. Don't want to do it. And then I was getting too old to gallop horses, and I broke my back twice. And I had this
twice.
Yeah. Once, first time was in a car, and the second time the horse flipped on me.
Wow.
And, but the next thing I said, had this friend of mine who I would break horses for. And he said to me, why don't you keep this horse? And I said, I don't want to do it. I said, send it to somebody else. And he said, I want you to train the horse. So I thought about it and thought about it. And my wife told me, she said, I'm tired of being married to an exercise rider. Don't you think it's time? And so I took the horse, and I won my first race with him, a horse called Magic Maker. And he sent me a few more, and it went from there.
Talking with trainer Kieran McGee here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So your wife, did you meet her on the racetrack as well?
Yes, I did. Yes, and we have a 12-year-old daughter, soon to be 13, and we've been together like 15 years now, and she loves the horses too. And believe me, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for her.
Really?
I mean, I wouldn't want to do it without her. We do it together.
Yeah. So she's still involved in the operation?
Oh, absolutely.
Every day?
Every day, yeah.
Yeah. How great is that to have her by your side?
Like I said, I wouldn't do it if she wasn't there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's to have somebody in your corner 100% is tremendous.
Yeah. How about your daughter? Is she into horse racing?
No. Not at all. No, not at all.
Do you want her to be?
No. She wants to go to college, which we're 100% behind. But she has 2 ponies and a horse. She goes to horse shows every weekend, loves that.
Yep.
And she was here last week, and we had a horse in, and she was playing on her iPad. And I said, Kieran, well, what's the race is going to run? And, I'm busy. We horse won the race, and she came back. She said, where were you? She said, the horse won. Oh, doesn't care. Has no interest whatsoever in it.
Wow, but you're okay with that.
Oh, I'm fine. I'm fine.
Yeah.
I mean, my father made us do it. I'm not. Whatever she wants to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now that you're having a lot of success here in Maryland, obviously the leading trainer here at Pimlico right now as we sit here today on the 14th of May, what is it that about your philosophy that's allowed you to have so much success?
Well, I'm a big believer in they have to be happy. The horses have to enjoy it. I do not train hard. I want them happy, and a happy horse will run, and that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to keep them happy.
It's kind of a European-style approach, isn't it?
Well, yeah, a little bit. We do a lot of jogging here, and I don't work – when I work horses, they don't work fast. I work them slow, and, I mean, it's been fun. It's worked so far, so –
Could you ever imagine that you'd be sitting here today as
No.
the leading trainer at Pimlico?
Absolutely not. No. And Hugh McMahon said to me at the beginning of the year, he said to me, this is your year. I see it coming. I've told a couple of people this is going to be a breakout year for you. And I was like, yeah, right. But it's been a lot of fun. Of course, winning is contagious. The more you win, the more you want to win.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That first year when you were just getting started, or the first couple of years, how difficult was that?
Quite difficult. Claiming horses, because that's what I do. I claim horses. We would look. The first horse we claimed, my wife and I, we maxed out. We borrowed $2,000 from three credit cards, borrowed $1,000 from my mother-in-law, and we went and claimed a horse. And we ran the horse back. He won. We ran him back again. He won again. And... But that was, had every penny we had was tied up in that.
Wow.
And yeah, and then we lost the horse for $10,000. And what started is going, you know.
What if it didn't work?
I wouldn't be sitting here.
Did you give that any thought? I mean, how nerve-wracking was that? You're maxing out the credit cards
and
or borrowing.
I was more nervous than my wife was, and that we had gone down to Laurel 2 or 3 days and chickened out on a couple of claims, and my wife just. Give me the slip. I'm going to drop it. I don't care. And she was the one who went and dropped the slip.
Well, you said it's great to have her by your side.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And it was her. She picked the horse out, and believe me, it was because I kept on thinking of what happens if the horse doesn't work out. Because let's face it, the chances are not in your favor.
Sure.
But that's what Samoon was the name of the filly, and that's what started us going.
So from that point on, you've been able to develop a relationship with several clients, I assume, and kind of a niche. You talked about claiming horses.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole different game, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Than playing it at the really high level of the game.
It's a gamble, and your owner's got to realize it's a gamble. And I've had 3 or 4 owners that are very good claimers, and they love the action. And you're going to make bad claims, and you got to just... You know, you got to realize it and just move on. Don't throw good money after bad and find them a home and move on.
Do you have a certain philosophy when you're looking to claim a horse, or is it based on the individual
horse and what barn it's coming out of and who's had the horse before and how they do and what they do and how they train and basically, you look at everything.
Yeah.
And the horse's numbers. Some of my owners look at different things. I have a friend, Jim Wolf. He's a big numbers guy, and he's got like 6 or 7 horses with me. And he'll go back and watch all the races, and he's very serious about it. And then other ways, but Jim does his homework.
Yeah. How much will you pay attention to the races and watch replays and those?
I will at night. I go back 2 or 3 races, and usually that's as far as I go. But Jim will go back. He does all his homework and he enjoys it.
What are you looking for when you watch the replays?
Reasons why, how you can move up a horse, or feeding, or how the horses look, how their coats look, and how they're acting in the races before, if they're dull or, you know.
Do you have a game plan before you claim the horse and say, okay, here's where I want to go, or what direction I want to go in with this horse if I'm going to claim him?
No, actually, I don't. And some people do. A lot of people do. And we claim the horse, and we have an idea what we want to do, but we not usually. We take the horse and then see how they come out of the race, and then make up a plan.
How much would you love to be playing at the level of, say, the Kentucky Derby or the Preakness, you know, these Triple Crown races? Is that something that motivates you and drives you?
No.
Really?
No. I'm quite happy where I'm at, and of course, everybody would like to be there, but I'm a realist, you know. So I take what I can get and be thankful, you know.
And if that horse comes along.
That's fine. That's fine. I'll be more than happy to make room for him.
You're coming off of the best year of your career.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, according to Equibase, 49 winners in 2013, nearly $1 million in purse earnings. That's impressive for somebody that's playing the claiming game.
Exactly. And the percentages last year were tremendous, especially first off the claim. We did really well first off the claim, and which is always fun. You always, when you claim a horse, you want to turn them around.
Yeah.
It always, it drives you to make you, you always want to do better.
I was going to ask you what motivates you, but you might have just answered that question.
Yeah.
It's always trying to improve.
Exactly.
So do you actually, at the beginning of the year, did you set a goal this year and say, okay, I want to do this, this, and this?
No, but you all, every year you want to improve. And I have done that in the last few years. One year I came close. I'd won 31 races, and I was stuck on 31 the following year, and I had like four or five horses left. I'm going, gotta win one more. Finally, the last horse I ran won. I was like, you know, because all year long I could say, I gotta do better. Every year he's gotta be a little bit better.
Yeah.
So,
talking with trainer Kieran McGee here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. So looking ahead to this year and what you project happening this year, some of the goals that you set, just to be better than last year? Is it that simple?
To win more races and more purse money. I mean, every year it's human nature, I believe.
Yeah.
And it is for me.
Tell me about some of the horses that you've been around that have touched you, that you say, okay, maybe this wasn't the fastest horse, or he wasn't but boy, he tried hard. Who are some of those horses you're always going to remember?
One of my favorites of all will always be the first horse I had, Magic Maker, and I sold him. Ernie Orr bought him off me to make a jump horse out of him. We won. He was half brother to a nice jump horse, and we sold him. But he's the coolest horse. But he'd probably always be my favorite, and he was a cool horse, just a cool horse.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, well, it's not really funny, but we hear this a lot in the game where so many trainers that are involved, they become so attached to certain horses. And for example,
that's my wife.
Really?
Yeah. And we lose a horse. Oh, the drive home is not pretty. Not pretty.
Yeah, that's the thing. People don't realize that trainers, even though they run horses in claiming races, it's not necessarily to get rid of them.
Yeah.
It's just where the horse fits.
Needs to fit. Yeah.
And sometimes if you lose them, it can be
absolutely
heartbreaking, can't it?
Oh, and my wife is, of all my owners, my wife's the worst. I mean, she just gets emotional with them and is not happy.
Yeah.
Especially, and now she's not rubbing. We have enough horses now. She doesn't rub anymore. So she's not as hands-on the horses, because when she rubbed them, she falls in love with them. And she would make me claim horses back because she loved them so much. And we claimed horses back just to retire them, because I don't care. She said, whatever they're running back, take this horse back, because I want to make sure this horse has a good home.
Yeah.
And we've done that.
How do you make sure that they have a good home? Are there certain people you work with here
in
the area that...
Absolutely. And we've claimed three or four horses and retired them that day just to make sure they deserved it, and cool horses, and they all deserve it, though.
Yeah.
But, you know, but we've done it, and we've just claimed one back that we lost. We got him back. My wife was furious that we lost the horse, and she said, I don't care what he runs him back for, you claimed his horse back. I said, okay.
That's got to make it fun when you get home at night.
when the day we lost him, I wouldn't walk down there, because my wife was down there. I said, I'm going the other way, because I knew she was not good.
What would you consider to be your career highlight to this point?
Well, I claimed a horse a few years ago, Tony. And Tony's the One was our name, and we claimed her for 10. We just got beat a nose in the stake, and she won like three or four allowance races for us, four or five allowance races. She was one of my favorites. And Maritius Tune, a filly that we claimed for 12.5, and we won like eight or nine starter races with her on the grass. She was a lot of fun, and she had a lot of personality. I would say those two are my favorites.
How about your moment where you say, oof, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Maybe I made the wrong move with that horse. Is there a moment that sticks out to you and you go, ugh, that wasn't right. Come on, Kieran.
Well, I've done that too. Absolutely. We've all done that. And a couple of claims I made, I go, oh, we shouldn't have played that horse. That was a mistake. And, I mean, that happens. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, where before we would claim horses at the bottom level, now we're claiming horses at the higher end. So it gives you wiggle room. You have room to drop. If you take a bad one, you're a slow horse, and you can drop them down and hopefully get your money back.
When you find the right horse and everything goes well and you get that horse and he improves and everything goes the way you think it should, does that make you want to find another horse like that even more once you get a taste of it?
And you can't, and you can do, I've claimed some horses off certain people and done, and you hit the mother load. You do great. The horse comes up out of the race and you come back and win three or four races with him, and this is a nice horse, and someone will say, well, let's go take another one off. I'm like, slow down here. I said, don't go back to the well too many times. I mean, because you will get burnt.
Do you have go-to trainers that you look at their horses first if you're going to be looking?
Yeah.
Go-to barns?
Yeah. Yes, I do. There's a few I look at, and I won't mention any names.
Sure.
But, yeah, there are.
Yeah, and you try to focus on those barns first before you go other directions. Outside of horse racing, when Kieran McGee gets a few minutes to get away from the track and training, which I know is rare, what other hobbies do you have? What other things do you like to do?
Play golf.
Yeah?
Badly. Badly, but it's fun. I play
better golfer than you were a rider?
No. About the same. About the same. I played in the tournament last week. And we didn't do any good, and we had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And it was for a charity thing, but
did you play golf in Ireland?
Candied in Ireland. Did a lot of candying over there as a kid.
Really?
For money. My father never paid us when we worked for him, so we had to go candy.
Well, Dad never paid you.
No,
really?
We worked for nothing. Are you kidding me? Absolutely. We get up in the morning, and then we come home from school, we had to get back in the yard. Everybody else went and played sports. We got back in the yard and did horses up.
Sure. So you never got to play any other sports outside of maybe caddying for golf.
Caddying, yeah. We did a little soccer when we were kids, a little bit of soccer, but we did a lot of caddying.
Yeah.
For money.
Yeah, and that doesn't help you with your golf game now, all that caddying experience?
I can find golf balls pretty good in the woods.
It's usually mine that you're finding, by the way. I can tell you that for a fact. So just golf, or are there other things?
No, that's basically it, yeah.
Yeah. How about vacation destinations here? Are there any place when you get away you like to go with the
family? My daughter loves Ireland. We used to go, my mother died a couple of years ago, and before that, We every other year I'd go to Ireland, and every other year my mother would come over here. So my daughter used to say to her every year, where do you want to go on vacation? Ireland. I said, come on, let's go somewhere warm. No, Daddy, let's go to Ireland. And so she loved it over there. My wife loved it over there. We went over there the first time I took her there. We were there 3 days, and my wife said, let's move here. She'd live there. My daughter would live there, but...
Wow.
Not for me. I mean, this is home for me.
Where do you even find time in your schedule? Training horses is 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Where do you find time for vacations? How do you do that?
You just do it. You just have to take it. There's usually 4 or 5 day vacations you take. But you just got to do it, because otherwise life passes you by.
Yeah, that's true. Kieran McGee, my special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. So, what's next for Kieran McGee? What do we look forward to up the road?
Well, when this place closes up here in a couple of weeks, we'll ship to Delaware and wherever we need to go and try and keep winning.
Is it mostly the Mid-Atlantic? Is that where
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
This is home for me.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about going to Monmouth for the summer, and I've been waiting 5 years for Pimlico to stay open, so it's finally staying open, and Bowie is coming to an end, so I'm going to stay here.
Well, you said you wanted to go someplace warm. How about the winter? Any thoughts of going to Gulfstream or Tampa or any of those tracks?
No. The purses are so bad down there, and everything's so expensive. It's financially, it's not worth it. It's just not worth it.
Well, it's been worth it for you here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Leading trainer at Pimlico. Stay hot. Keep it rolling. And thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much.
Great
pleasure.
To hear your story. Kieran McGee.
My pleasure.
Of course, Tim Keefe in the first half of the program. If you did miss any portion of the show, you can go to our website, horseracingradio.net. A podcast will be available. You can listen to all of our trainer talk shows on our website. And don't forget to check out our BristNet.com call-in show every Thursday evening, our Express Bet Weekend Stakes preview show every Friday night at 6 o'clock Eastern Time, and of course all of our race coverage on the weekends, including the exclusive national broadcast of the 139th Preakness coming up this Saturday. That entire schedule, listing of affiliates, and SiriusXM channel information is on our website, horseracingradio.net. Been an awful lot of fun here tonight. For my producers, Lee Delapina and Sean C., I'm Mike Penham. We'll talk to you later.